So it is 11:36 and you are listening to Legalese on CKUT 90.3 FM. Thank you to Rachel and Katrina for that wonderful information session, and a shout out to all of the Munaca workers who are outside on the picket lines right now. And our last piece for today's show is from Jesse Gutman, who is in Toronto, but he is also a co-host and regular contributor to Legalese. And he's given us a little radio documentary on labor unions. So here's Jesse.
Workers and bosses, unions and employers. Why is labor so controversial? Today we look at the world of labor law. This documentary will focus on the recent labor unrest in the United States, relating the themes to Canada. The word to strike. In 1810, it meant concentrated cessation of work by a body of employees. From the verb refuse to work to force an employer to meet demands in 1768, so it's from a verb. And this is perhaps taken from the notion of striking or downing one's tools, or the practice in the 16th century of sailors lowering their ships as a symbol of refusal to go to sea. In the 20th century, many international bodies recognized the right to strike through the freedom of peaceful assembly and association. It is recognized in the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 11. It is also recognized with the International Labor Organization's Convention on the Right to Organize and Bargain Collectively in 1948. But there's still a lot of controversies about strikes, and we're going to hear a little bit about it with our first clip here. Elaine Bernard is a professor at the Harvard Law School, and she's going to give a nice historical sketch from about 1935 to the present day of private unions, public unions, and the 1935 Wagner Act. This is an important milestone for labor in North America, and indeed around the world, and it will set up a trajectory for our conversation this morning.
So let me, if I get my numbers right, we're about 7.5% of the private sector are unionized, maybe 11% in the public sector. So why are the numbers so low?
The U.S. has been seeing the decline of unions really since, as a density, that is the proportion of the workforce that is in unions, since 1955. But in absolute numbers, the number of folks in unions since about 1981. And most of the story is a decline in the private sector. What we've seen is, in fact, if we go back to 1973, maybe one in four Americans who were working, whether a public sector worker or a private sector worker, was in a union. Today, one in 13 in the private sector is in a union, whereas one in three is in a union in the public sector. So we've seen, in fact, the growth of unions in the public sector to a point where, you know, today it's 36.8%, 37% of the workforce, and huge decline in the private sector.
So in the private sector, the numbers have gone from 15 million down to 8.2 million, whereas the public sector has gone from 3 up to 7.8. So talk about some of the reasons for this.
One of the key reasons given, of course, is the law is very different. Most people don't realize that private sector employees are under one national law that goes back to 1935, the National Labor Relations Act. And that law has changed mostly not through legislation, but actually through very undemocratic decisions made by judges who know modestly nothing about the workplace.
For example?
It's written into the labor law that, and internationally, that workers have a right to strike. Right to strike is pretty fundamental. In U.S. labor, private sector law, you have the right to strike. But the judges have looked at that and said, you have the right to strike, and we can't take that away, but we've decided that you can be permanently replaced. Now, I teach international labor relations, and I go to other countries, and try to explain to a normal person in another country that, well, you've got the right to strike, which means in every country that you can't be fired for going on strike. But in the U.S., you can be permanently replaced. So you're not fired. You just lost your job permanently.
Permanently replaced means we can hire scabs, keep them, and you can stay out as long as you like.
What normally happens is if you then decide, gee, we've lost this strike, I'm going back to work. I admit, I give up, I yield, I'm coming back to work. Normally, that means that the temporary replacement worker needs to lose their job because they're temporary. And the worker who went on strike and therefore didn't lose their job, just left their job for a short while to engage in legal strike activity, they are returned to their job. In the United States, this striker replacement means that, you know, that you've more or less lost your job. It's not there for you anymore.
Quebec and British Columbia have so-called anti-scab legislation as well. Linking to that piece. Similar numbers and trends for unionization exist in Canada. Like in the United States, the right to strike flows from freedom of association and the right to collectively bargain. In Canada, there has been some debate over this point. In a landmark decision, BC Health Services, the Supreme Court recognized that collectively bargaining is connected to freedom of association. Section 2D of the Charter. This, however, was limited by a recent 2011 decision called Fraser. Moving on, we look at two competing narratives on unionization. The first is from the AFL-CIO, which has over 11 million members. The second is a training video for the retail chain Target, which has revenues of more than $67 billion US and nearly 400,000 employees. We will transition afterwards into Amy Goodman and Naomi Klein's conversation on Wisconsin and Michigan from March 2011. They discuss the right to strike and to collectively organize, how it is under attack in industrialized nations, and specifically, Naomi Klein links this to her recent work, The Shock Doctrine.
The Pennsylvania AFL-CIO presents A Brief History of Unions. A long time ago, when our great country was just being built, there were the haves
money, money, money.
And the have-nots. The haves owned companies and industries, and they relied on their workers to, well, do the hard work. The workers were proud of what they did. They worked hard every day. But they watched the companies and the haves get richer and richer while they got poorer or stayed the same. They had to work for as long as their bosses told them to work. They didn't get overtime pay, they didn't get to take a break, and there was no guarantee they would be safe at work. If they got hurt or even killed, the company didn't have to do anything about it.
This isn't fair!
The workers decided to do something about it. But it was hard. The companies could just fire them.
They're lost.
So the workers joined in unity. Together, they had a voice. Together, they could demand things like fair wage, safe working conditions, an end to child labor, sick leave, family leave, pensions. Together, labor unions created something in between the haves and the have-nots, the middle class. The middle class is very important. It allows people to make better lives for themselves, and the middle class has money to spend, and when they buy things, that money goes back into our economy, and it makes America strong.
Welcome to Target, where we know you'll have a terrific experience. I'm Doug.
And I'm Maria. And even if you already started working here, you're already part of an important team and a great Target store.
That's right. Now, you were chosen to work in our store because we think you'll help us achieve our vision of being the best company ever.
You'll probably learn something new every day, at least for a little while.
There'll also be a lot of challenges, but there's nothing we can't solve by working together. The leadership team and your fellow team members are anxious to help you and to make working at Target a positive and rewarding experience.
If you ever have a question, all you have to do is ask it. Everyone here from the CEO down wants you to be successful. In fact, Target prides itself on our open door policy. Ask your team leader, ask your ETL, or ask any supervisor. Their doors and every door are always open to you and what you have to say. Two-way communication, fair dealings are a key part of our culture and a key part of our success.
We're a Target because we're a threat to unions. The unions that represent grocery store workers.
When we take business away from unionized grocery stores, that means they need fewer employees.
And fewer grocery store employees mean fewer union members. And fewer members, well, that's a problem for the union business. That's right. I said business. Union business.
A union is not a charity. It's not a club. And it's not part. It's a business. A business that has to take in money to survive. But it doesn't have any products to sell. All it has is memberships to sell. A union's only source of income is the money they charge members.
Money for initiation, dues, and fines, and assessments. You get the picture. So it's pretty obvious that the fewer members their business has, the less money they collect.
The union's only alternative is to get more people to pay their hard-earned money to them in dues every month.
And that's becoming more and more of a problem for unions every day. 50 years ago, one out of every three workers was in a union. Today, that number, excluding government workers, has dropped to less than 1 in 10.
One of the biggest reasons is that workers know that all the good things unions once did, child safety laws, workman's comp, all of that, they're all laws today. Laws protecting workers. They were passed a long time ago.
And nobody wants to pay dues for something they already have.
Numbers just keep going down. You can see why the union would want to organize us here at Target.
Hi, I'm Jim Router. Team members have the right to join unions, but they also have a right not to join a union. Experience has shown us that, after learning the facts, Target team members agree union representation is not in their best interest. In fact, not one group of Target team members today has chosen to be represented by a union. Ultimately, what works best for Target and our team members is the ability to meet challenges, resolve issues, and grow the business together without the interference of a union or other third party.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Rallies for workers' rights are spreading across the country. In Michigan, over 1,000 people rallied at the state capitol in Lansing to oppose a measure allowing the breaking of labor contracts by placing schools and districts under emergency management. In a scene reminiscent of Wisconsin, hundreds of demonstrators packed the Capitol Rotunda chanting slogans. Protests were also held against anti-union bills Tuesday in Indiana, Ohio, Iowa, Florida, and Tennessee. Meanwhile, in Idaho, the state legislature has given final approval to a measure restricting the collective bargaining of public school teachers. The bill would limit teachers' collective bargaining to salaries and benefits. It also ends teacher tenure, limits teacher contracts to 1 year, and removes seniority as a factor in determining layoffs. As a wave of anti-union bills are introduced across the country in the wake of the Great Recession, many analysts are picking up on the theory that award-winning journalist and author Naomi Klein first argued in her best-selling book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. In it, she reveals how those in power use times of crisis to push through undemocratic, radical, free-market economic policies. Nobel Prize-winning economist, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman recently referenced the book in his column called Shock Doctrine USA. He wrote, quote, "The story of the privatization-obsessed coalition provisional authority in Iraq was the centerpiece of Naomi Klein's best-selling book, The Shock Doctrine, which argued that it was part of a broader pattern. From Chile in the 70s onward, she suggested right-wing ideologues have exploited crises to push through an agenda that has nothing to do with resolving those crises and everything to do with imposing their vision of a harsher, more unequal, less democratic society," which brings us to Wisconsin 2001, where the shock doctrine is on full display, Krugman wrote. Well, Naomi Klein joins us today in our studio for Before the Hour. In addition to the Shock Doctrine, she's the author of two previous books, No Logo, Taking Aim at Brand Bullies, and Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate. She's currently writing a new book, which focuses on the public relations campaign distorting climate change facts. Naomi Klein, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy. Great to see you.
It's great to have you with us. Let's talk Wisconsin. What do you see is happening in this uprising?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's such an incredible example of how to resist the shock doctrine. And it should not be in any way surprising that we are seeing right-wing ideologues across the country using economic crisis as a pretext to really wage a kind of a final battle in a 50-year war against trade unions, where we've seen membership in trade unions drop precipitously. And public sector unions are the last labor stronghold, and they're going after it. And these governors did not run elections promising to do these radical actions, but they are using the pretext of crisis to do things that they couldn't get elected promising to do. And, you know, that's the core argument of the thesis of the book, is not that there's something wrong with responding to a crisis decisively. Crises demand decisive responses. The issue is this backhanded attempt to use a crisis to centralize power, to subvert democracy, to avoid public debate, to say we have no time for democracy, it's just too messy, it doesn't matter what you want, we have no choice, we just have to ram it through. And we're seeing this in 16 states. I mean, it's impossible to keep track of it. It's happening on such a huge scale. Teachers' unions are getting the worst of it. Yesterday was International Women's Day. This is, you know, as you pointed out on your show, it's overwhelmingly women who are providing the services that are under attack. It's not just labor that's under attack. It's the services that the labor is providing that's under attack. It's healthcare, it's education. It's those fundamental caregiving services across the country, which could be profitable if they were privatized.
In Ohio, more than 20,000 people marched to oppose the Republican Governor John Kasich's attempted anti-union legislative putsch. Kasich recently defended his policy proposals on Fox and Friends.
It's part of a big piece of reform. Come March the 15th, we will be reforming Medicaid, K through 12, higher ed, prisons. It is going to be a reform agenda in Ohio like no one has ever seen, all designed to get us in a good position. In terms of unions, I respect unions. I come from a union family. I mean, the idea that we're attacking anybody is, look, what we're attacking, poverty, joblessness. Okay, that's what I'm attacking. And all I'm doing is saying to everybody, participate. Everybody jump in this. Together, we can make Ohio stronger. If we do not do that, you know, then we'll continue to lose jobs, and that means misery for everybody. That's not going to happen. We are going to be successful here.
Republican Governor John Kasich, going back to his old haunt, he was a commentator for a long time for Fox, and before that, a conservative congressman.
You know, the reason why this isn't working and why people are so outraged by it and why they're in the streets and we're finally seeing the resistance in this country that we have seen in Europe with this, you know, chant, we won't pay for your crisis, that really started in 2008 in Greece and spread to Italy and France and England. And you know, the rest of the world has been waiting for the United States to you know, how much are Americans going to take of this? It seems that Americans were willing to say, you know, we will pay for your crisis, and would you like a tax break with that, right? And finally, they went too far. And so that resistance is finally happening. And this attack on collective bargaining, the reason why people won't take it is precisely because they understand that this is not shared pain. It is not being shared equally. The people who created the crisis in the first place are not sharing the pain. And the injustice of this response is so blatant. This isn't just any economic crisis. This tactic has worked, and this is, you know, what I've tracked over a 30-year period, that it is really easy to use an economic crisis. People panic, hyperinflation, issues like that. In the 90s, when Newt Gingrich was Speaker, it was possible for him to argue that the source of the budget crisis really was so-called entitlement programs. You cannot do that in this moment in history because everybody understands that the crisis was created on Wall Street. It was created through speculation and greed. And a decision was made to bail out the bankers with public money and to pass the bill on to the public. And they're seeing the bonuses back. They're seeing the outrageous salaries. They're seeing corporations not paying their taxes. And it's just
too unjust. It's just so morally outrageous. And then to turn on the television and talk about everybody sharing the pain. I mean, people are just not that stupid. Thankfully.
And where does the Obama administration fit into this?
Yeah.
We have played that clip of President Obama when he was running for president saying, if anyone challenges your collective union rights, I will be walking with you.
Well, and this is the irony of this moment, and it really is about democracy. Scott Walker was not elected with a mandate to bust unions and to strip collective bargaining rights. He did not mention that in his campaign. He talked about balancing the budget. He made some vague statements, you know, about shared sacrifice, but he absolutely did not campaign promising to do what he is now doing. Obama, on the other hand, campaigned promising to strengthen union rights. He promised again and again whenever he had a labor audience that he was going to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, and he promised to stand with them. And, you know, one of the things that's so important for us to understand about why, you know, there are many reasons why the resistance is so strong in Wisconsin and why they've become this beacon for not just the rest of the country, but the world. And so much of it, I think, you know, my colleague at The Nation, John Nichols, has written beautifully about it this week in a cover story where he talks about the rich sense of collective history, of collective memory, and the fact that people know their progressive history in Wisconsin, so they're harder to exploit. They're not going to fall for the latest Fox News messaging because they know their history.
Let me ask you about Michigan, and then we're going to go to a break.
Yeah.
About 1,000 people rallied in Michigan, reminiscent of Wisconsin. Talk about the proposal there.
You know, I just found out about this last night, and like I said, there's so much going on that these extraordinary measures are just getting lost in the shuffle. But in Michigan, there is a bill that's already passed the House. It's on the verge of passing the Senate. And I'll just read you some excerpts from it. It says that in the case of an economic crisis, that the governor has the authority to authorize the emergency manager, this is somebody who would be appointed, to reject, modify, or terminate the terms of an existing contract or collective bargaining agreement, authorize the emergency manager for a municipal government. Okay, so we're talking about towns, municipalities across the state, to disincorporate, so an appointed official with the ability to dissolve an elected body.
A
municipal government. And it says specifically, or dissolve the municipal government. So we've seen this happening with school boards, you know, saying, okay, this is a failing school board, we're taking over, we're dissolving it, we're canceling the contracts. You know, what this reminds me of is New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, when the teachers were fired en masse, and then it became a laboratory for charter schools. And, you know, people in New Orleans, and you know this, Amy, warned us. They said, what's happening to us is going to happen to you. And I included in the book a quote saying, you know, every city has their lower ninth ward, and what we're seeing with the pretext of the flood is going to be used with the pretext of an economic crisis, and this is precisely what's happening. So it starts with the school boards, and then it's whole towns, whole cities that could be subject to just being dissolved because there's an economic crisis, breaking collective bargaining agreements. It also specifies that this bill specifies that an emergency manager can be an individual or a firm. So the person who would be put in charge of this so-called failing town or municipality could actually be a corporation.
Whose government they dissolve. A company takes over.
A company takes over. So they have created, and if this passes, the possibility for privatization of a whole